Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and I'm so delighted you're able to join me today because we have a very interesting guest. So many times in our world, we are limited in our exposure to information. Information about cultures, people, situations, because we're given bite-sized micro moments of information. So how can we expand our understanding? It usually comes about because we ask questions or we have an opportunity to talk with someone who has had experiences that we are not aware of. My guest today, Atta Arghandawal, was born in Afghanistan but has lived more than half of his life in the West, and he left Afghanistan about 8 months after the Russians invaded his country. Now, that was in August of 1980. He was in Germany, he immigrated to the United States, and he has been a very successful man. We're going to have the opportunity to talk with Atta and to find out the real story about his country and what his perceptions are today. Atta, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Donna, for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I am always of a mind that we need to hear people's stories that have actually lived the experience. And, of course, we all have our own paradigms of perception dependent on what that experience has been. Your book really was quite an eye-opener for me. Because unlike what's being broadcast today about so many components in Afghanistan, your world at that time was much different. Tell us about what Afghanistan was like prior to the Russian invasion in 1980.
Sure. Well, thank you very much. I think you put it in the right perspective in terms of understanding the real story. And basically, that's exactly what motivated me to write the book. As you know, there are so many great material out there in terms of political, geographical books, history books, and what we are hearing through the news and tubes on CNN or whatever other media coverages that might be available. But the fact of the matter remains that the real true story of what Afghanistan was all about I thought it was going to be best that I describe it through my eye, witness stories in my lifetime experience. So going to your question about what Afghanistan was before the Russian invasion, quite frankly, Afghanistan has relatively really enjoyed a very peaceful time, I would say, right after World War II, really all through the I would say early 70s, even up through early 70s, a very peaceful environment where people of various ethnic groups, especially during kingdom, where King Zahir Shah was the king, they lived together with so much harmony, with so much respect for each other, in a peaceful time where the country was considered one of the top tourist destinations in the world, where basically people of all over the world will enjoy coming to Afghanistan, enjoying its amazing traditions, food, costumes, and then the countryside, the four seasons, mm-hmm. and all the beauties that really came along with it, where people in Afghanistan really, again, lived in total peace and harmony, and they enjoyed a real great life. And that's where a lot of people, especially in the Western society, do not know or hear about. And so that's what really motivated me to go back and take everybody towards those days where, again, life was very different from what it is today.
I agree. In fact, I recall when Lebanon was a place. I can remember hearing stories about Lebanon, and it almost is parallel with Afghanistan.
Right.
It was a culturally rich environment. Everybody from all kinds of backgrounds would go there. It was known as an international marketplace. There, it didn't make any difference what your religion was. There were not the extremist groups. It was just incredible. So when I started reading your story, Lost Decency, and you started off in your book talking about your father and how your father, due to circumstances, this was about 1959, the women in your country had freedom. They were encouraged to get educated. In fact, your father was a strong advocate of that. It is so different. It was so different than what is being portrayed today, both for men and women. And your dad was educated. Your mother was very knowledgeable. And your dad was a powerful government official. And you started getting involved with the Soviets. Why did this happen? What was the catalyst for this?
First, like I think, as I refer to the kingdom and time, which I call it an impoverished kingdom, although there was not too much progress, but it was really steady progress. I would say that he was such a charismatic figure that he was able to really keep all the tribals in all of the ethnic groups within the country in total respect of each other. And the time that, you know, there was, again, progress was there and education was there, and then it was, the country was trying to exploit its natural resources. And I think that's when the time when Russia, which has the, you know, the largest border with Afghanistan, really, I think, that seen the benefit of or putting its eye on the ice on focusing on the natural resources of Afghanistan. And as they started to penetrate inside the Afghan society by building or helping or actually organizing these communist parties within various areas. And these were, of course, illegal or underground, but that work really took and started well in the early 50s. Well, it wasn't just really actually Soviet Union at the time, but even China. And there was an underground communist party in Iran who also had kind of somehow penetrated. And we in schools kind of realized that when we were going to high school that there were actually activities taking place. So it took its form, and it actually improved. It actually grew to the point where Soviet Union was able to actually penetrate, or the communist regime really penetrated the Afghan military. And I think that's when really things changed, when they started to penetrate and grow its institution within the military. And that really actually caused the country to kind of shake itself up and start strikes and demonstrations against the kingdom, asking for more reforms and more progress. And that was the time when we actually felt the Russian influence, if you will. And it took its form and all the way up to 1978, where they were actually able to overthrow the government by throwing a coup d'etat. So basically all again started in early 50s, but really took its strong form to overthrow the government through Afghan local communist groups in 1978.
There is a little bit more history that I want to touch upon. And again, you mentioned this in your book, that there was independence from Great Britain that was attained in 1919. So it had been part of the colonialization of Britain. And
absolutely,
under King Amalula, and I may not be pronouncing that correctly, so please accept my apologies.
It is right. You said it right.
I said it right. Okay,
yes.
Khan, this man, he was in power for 10 years, and because of him, the move towards modernization was just absolutely wonderful. However, what did come in were the Afghan tribal positioning.
Right.
And then you had all of these political manipulations, which are still going on today, because Afghanistan is landlocked. You are right in the middle of a number of other boundaries, territories, And historically, Afghanistan has had to battle more than once just to try to maintain its own individuality.
That is correct. Unfortunately, it's almost become a punching bag of many empires and the conquerors that have wanted to cross the country. But you refer to a period that was absolutely the highlight of African history, of those 10 years under Amin Ullah Khan, where progress was enormous. And it was just incredible. But the influence of extremists, I would say not the same extremists of today's magnitude, but those were the ones that even the tribal areas that kind of saw the progress in a way of getting in the a way of religion, if you will, or saw him as somebody who was a modernist and who was actually even referred to as a communist, where people wanted to do more than just the traditional kingdom type of environment. So that really hurt Afghanistan and it set us back, because when you look at his 10 years, it's amazing. As you know, Afghanistan has retained its independence in the same year as Japan did. And look at the difference. But had Amin Ullah Khan been allowed to live longer or be there, Afghanistan would have never been in the situation that it is today. But you're absolutely right as far as, again, people wanted to get its hands on Afghanistan in the three wars against British and the defeat. It has really set back Afghanistan and for many, many years. So there has been constantly setback after setback where innocent people have not been allowed to find their way towards real, I would say, peace.
Yes, and compared to what was going on previously, and after World War II, a modern university was built. Yep. Women in Afghanistan were in all kinds of fields, including medicine, which had been closed down before them. And they were told not to wear the old traditional dress. They were to dress in modern attire. And it was amazing. I mean, absolutely amazing. And you had a literacy level which is not there today. It's just totally gone 180 degrees in the other way because of the different factions, the political manipulation, the destruction. Women now are just treated horribly. I mean, it's just, and the children are treated horribly. When I was reading this information, and I was thinking about, wow, here there was this phenomenal, major, giant step forward that the people of the country overall really embraced. They really embraced it. They wanted it. They were thriving in it. It was moving forward. And yet a combination of things internally as well as externally had a profound influence. And when the Russians came in and there was this indoctrination process that went through, and unless anybody's ever known anyone that's come from a communist-dominated country, you really aren't going to understand it. And I've had the exposure to people that have been in those environments. And to break loose from that, I mean, their lives, their families, their property, often they were held hostage. Yep. And you managed to escape. Now, this is something a lot of people, unless they know someone, and I'm repeating this for a reason, when you are not in the environment, when you're not a part of it, when you have never experienced this kind of oppression, your brother fought for years for the elimination of this, and he passed away in 2010. What happened with your family that caused you to be the first one to leave? And your life was in danger throughout the entire process, as well as the lives of your family. Tell us what happened to get you to that point, and how did you get out of there?
Correct, Donna. Great question. As you know, I came from a big family, and there were 10 of us in the kids, especially the girls, that 7 sisters at the time. And they were very young, and as my father got ill and we lost him, and I was actually in the army right after high school. So what really happened was in with these political changes coming in, and we could see the danger because you had to really cooperate. You had to somehow help out. Almost their expectation was that every family or every working person will somehow be invited to a communist gathering or party at some point. So there was always, everybody was under a lot of stress. And for myself, having studied English at the American, basically classes there, or English classes of United States Embassy at one time when we had finished all of our English studies there, being and then working at Intercontinental under you know, a company that was an American-run organization of Pan American at the time. So there were some really reasons that I was watched more carefully because I was associated to be obviously with the Western and the United States in particular. So those things, you could see that there was always pressure and that I would be followed quite a bit. And I realized that it was going to become dangerous as we were studying our family environment. And my brother's intention to continue his fight against the communist regime, we thought that it was we need to do something to really rescue the girls in particular. I think that was the biggest motivation, and my mother, and of course, that was the biggest thing that made me start thinking about getting out, because I was actually at the point where my next capture would have been the end of me, probably family. And then we went through some very tough times during some interrogations and doing some weapon searches in our neighborhood. So I really thought that it was best that I knew some English, that I could get out to work and then rescue the rest of the family. And this was the time when millions of other people were either trying to walk through neighboring countries or some were able to fly out of the country. So that's kind of what pushed me to the edge where I said, you know, I think it's time for me to get out. And I was very, very fortunate in doing that because a lot of other people did not succeed. But for me to be able to get away, and it opened up the door, of course, for the rest of the family to be rescued.
One of the components that you brought out in your book that I think is especially significant, especially with 9/11 and the extremists that attacked our country, and we're still battling this today. This has not gone away.
Right.
The image, the understanding of the Islamic community has been very confused. There's a lot of anger, which is understandable. I mean, anybody is going to, you know, be angry when someone attacks them. I don't care what your ethnicity is or your gender. I mean, this is just a natural reaction. But in your book, you state that the Islamic community is not of this violent dispositioning. Women were held in regard. They were treated with respect. Children were taken care of. And it was factions of the community. As it could be said, there are those in the Christian community. There are those in the Jewish community. I mean, this is human nature. There are always these little groupings. And when combined with the communist Marxist philosophy, it created literally a hell of hell for the very peaceful and in all respects honorable people of Afghanistan. I mean, it threw a horrific image over because of what a few who wanted to have power did.
I think that's, Donna, again, an excellent point where in the motivation behind telling stories such as and where taking people back to the history and to the time and traditions where religion, for example, it was phenomenal. It was probably the best form of Islam. I don't know how many forms exist to me. That was only one form. It will always be one form of Islam, which taught just so much respect, so much dignity, and so much respect for women. You know, the teamwork and the again taking care of people, being a good citizen. I mean, the things that we grew up with in the environment. So that's when I take that back always, and I think about it, and I say, wow, you know, the factionists or the extremists, and in all of these political environments, look at what it has created. Look at the image that it has created.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as understanding, like you said, I completely understood. I cried after 9/11 and always when you look at these things and you say, you know what? It's amazing how they manipulated this beautiful religion to what it is today, which is really not the nature of this religion, and it shouldn't be. But like you said, they exist, and it's just too bad that they took advantage and they succeeded in actually really painting this bad image to a point where today, and I think the Muslim society in particular, and their leaders in particular, in my mind, they need to do a better job than they have been doing. I think they need to come out, they need to talk, they need to be able to educate people. And they need to really, I think, share the real true great message of peace and prosperity and humanity versus and even in support of these extremists sometimes, which I have a difficulty with. So you're absolutely right. I think it's been very damaging. And it's something that our children of the world, you know, no matter what nation, what new country, we don't need that. We just don't need that. And it's not something that will actually help us as we grow and move forward into a global society that I call it. It's just not a global economy anymore. I believe it's the world is connected and should be. But you're absolutely right. They have really done a real big damage, but people are responsible. I think people of any religion to really come out and speak about the beauties of what it can be and what could attract people to it rather than drive people away from it.
You make a comment, and I'm going to quote it directly from your book. Dictatorship and totalitarianism became the only visible signs of the regime's political attitude towards the public. Now, this next thing that I'm going to share, very few people are aware of, that because of the dictatorship and totalitarianism, the attitude of those at the top was the army was given power. They imprisoned hundreds and thousands of men and women that were against the new regime and Communist Party. Mass disappearances and slaughter were occurring on a daily basis. And that is when millions of Afghans started to escape to Pakistan and Iran. And those that had the means went to India and Europe. Now, you yourself started off and you landed in Germany. That's where
right.
you were. And it was pretty tough there because you were, for all intents and purposes, an illegal alien. And even though you went through appropriate actions, you weren't allowed to work in Germany. And so a lot of what happened to those of you that were allowed into Germany, and you were recorded, people knew that you were there, they literally used you as slaves in Germany to do a lot of work that the average German wouldn't do.
Yeah, they really have some very discouraging programs. And I think reflecting back after 30 years, they've really done a disservice. And first, of course, you always admire that a refugee be allowed to be safe in an environment such as Europe. But it's what happens afterwards. You know, they have done a very, very poor job. Up to date, where I have so many relatives and friends in my own family, cousins, that live in Germany that have been living for a long, long time, and it's taken them so long to be allowed to be embedded in society, to be a part of the society. My question when I landed in Germany after a few months and I was thinking, wow, now that I'm here, it could become my second home, but for me to not be allowed to do anything productive, but to learn a language, or to be somehow assimilated into society, it was really a question. And I consider myself sometimes, yes, we were in prison type of environments. Yes, we had better food, we had better, you know, there were beds, and there were things that we didn't have in Afghanistan. But it really felt like being in prison. It really felt awful, and they have not succeeded in really, again, in assimilating people in their societies in a productive manner. So I really had a question even then and up to now where the refugees are somehow, and especially it's damaging for their kids, where their kids actually grew inside those camps and places where and they become prey to these extremists. So there is just a lot of, unfortunately, I would say, not productive programs that refugees put up with and they go through And some are just lucky for, like myself, who was able to just then leave Germany and come to the United States, and the rest was history. So I think it's really damaging sometimes when I look back at the policies of some of these governments that, again, initially allow refugees to come in. It's just such a poor job using them as productive members of society down the road.
Now, I will say this. Though the German government had a particular patterning, and there were those that worked for the government created underground situations that were very negative and had a very negative impact on the people that were exposed to them. There was a village that in Germany, once you were able to sit down and talk with the people, the whole disposition changed. And I want to go full circle with this. Because it is that communication. Let's face it, when you speak a different language and you don't really know what somebody else is saying, the normal positioning is, what if they want to come in and upset us? We don't understand them. We don't understand their culture. We don't know. It's different from ours. They're different, so they have to be bad. And my goodness, I've seen that happen in the United States over and over again. And I was born and raised here. This is just something I experienced when I was a kid with my father, who was Italian. And looking at the fears that the Italian people had, various cultural things, that the black people had, I've just seen so much through my life. And when I think of how when you came into this country, now it's a wonderful story about this group in Germany, but you said something that really touched my heart and mind, and it may be difficult for some people listening to understand it. You said, you along with other Afghans were learning and getting used to secrecy, deception, and being forced to hide simple facts of life. And again, unless someone has been put into a situation that is requiring this, and this is what your life experience it brought you. It's a very, very difficult thing to understand. But boy, I was reading through your book, Lost Decency, and it was just incredible. Now, when you came here to the United States, you had a very strong work ethic, and you went to work. You were given a job at a bank. And the amazing thing is that people hired you because of your qualifications, not because of your nationality. And they were so supportive of you, and you worked up into a very strong positioning in the bank, in management. You have been involved in banking for so many years. And you really demanded of your family, as you were able to get members of your family over here, the same work ethic. You said, you will be able to get some financial assistance, but you under no circumstances are going to allow to be on welfare, period. And I went, wow. I wish we had more Americans that had that kind of an attitude. Whoa, I'm serious. I really think that there's too many people that feel like they're entitled to being taken care of and not being productive. And this can be like a cancer. It can eat away. But you and your family, boy, you really set the tone.
You know, it was evident to me that the opportunity that I had, and I said, you know, and I saw actually, and I studied a little bit of what the refugees where immigrants were living in conditions early when I came in here and arrived in the Bay Area. And I realized that that was not the direction that I'm going to allow my family to go through. We were gone through so much, and they have talent. And you're absolutely right. That was my attitude. And thank God I did that. And I'm so proud of each and every one of them. Honestly, I'm the only one who did not actually go to further education or higher education degree, but every single one of them have done it. And I'm just so proud of them. But I really think that that's the tone that it should be set, hopefully, for the rest. And I actually regret the fact that many, many other, my own Afghan refugees who are immigrants in here have not been on the same page. And they are all either on welfare or not all, but there are some significant numbers that shouldn't have been, or on the social support and all. And it's not really a productive environment to be at. It's just not enjoyable.
Well, you give stats on how the Mujahideen were supported by the United States, and that is what crumbled the Soviet Union's economic base. You give so much particular information. You go into the current environment. You talk about where the Taliban came from, how it developed. And you just absolutely give such superb information in this book. I really think it's a compelling read. And more than anything else, it shows how a nation can be obliterated by a small group of people that the average citizen is not even aware of are aiming at taking things over. Started with the Russians, and it went from there. And the story of your nation is heartbreaking in many ways. Yet, because of the quality of character of those people like yourself that moved away, and you said, nope, we're going to be demonstrating something else, you have become, I think, part of the, what do I want to say, the bouillabaisse of humanity that will make a difference because of the ethics and integrity and sincere, heartfelt purpose that you believe that you should support. And I just think your book, Lost Decency, The Untold Afghan Story, is a real gem. And I'm so delighted that I became aware of it and that I've had the privilege of having you as a guest. Thank you, Otto, for being with me.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity, Donna. Just really very much appreciate it. And that's the whole thing, to be able to make a difference in the manner that I really thought it was very genuine, and I'm so happy for the opportunity and privilege, and thank you so much.
My pleasure. My guest today has been Atta Gandewal, and his book is Lost Decency. If you want to know the real story, not the political hype, not the media, whatever, if you want to know the essence of what happened, it's important to know about history and understand how the players have gotten into the position they've gotten into today. What was it that fertilized the anger and the hate so it grew into a weed of destruction that we have to, in one way or another, put in its proper place? It needs to be evaporated. But only if we're awake can we do that. Lost Decency, The Untold Afghan Story, I think gives you a lot to work with and a lot to think about. This is Donna Sebo. Go check out LostDecency.com. You'll find out more information about a very fine people and a culture that was destroyed because of the political powers in action that wanted what they had. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are now open, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Give me a call if you would just like to chat. And also, I would be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Again, call me at 888-627-6008. Well, next week we've got a dynamic lineup of people. We're going to be talking about lost civilizations. Philip Copens is going to be my guest. Then, a little bit of information about health and wellness and the magnesium miracle. Dr. Dean is going to be joining us. Are you aware that if you don't take adequate magnesium, you could take tons of calcium and the body's not going to use it? It's just going to throw it off. We're going to learn about that and even more. And my guest, Lou Paradise, may or may not be with us. We're not sure because he's in Upper New York. And as we all know, those poor people were hit so hard that it may not be possible for him to be with us. But if he's there, then we will have him on. Otherwise, it'll be an open mic day. Then we're going to be talking about Time of the Otter, Cora Holmes, The Aleutians. Ah, yes, we are going to be traveling to a place in the world that very, very few people even give 5 seconds of consideration to, Alaskan waters, of course. And then we're going to be talking with Yvonne Wakefield next week, suitcase filled with nails. We are going to find out what it's like to be a teacher in a Middle Eastern country. So we have this and much more, and then, of course, the listings for my guests for next month will be coming up. And all you have to do to find out a little bit more about the people who are coming up on the Donna Sebo Show is to check out the show information site on bbsradio.com, and you'll see what we will have coming up. As always, it's very eclectic, and I do think that it gives us opportunities to explore paradigms that maybe otherwise we would not even consider. Speaking of exploration, I wanted to talk about a man of history that we all have, well, been aware of. But first, let me just share this, because when we go back to the early days of the United States, it took a lot of, well, what do I want to say, discussion, argument, real determined action on the part of a group of men, and women, actually, that were in the background. But there was a fellow by the name of Andrew Bradford. He had a phenomenal business contract, and his company was given the responsibility of doing all the public printing for the new state of Pennsylvania. Now, Bradford's company, it was the big kahuna, if you will, using a modern term. This company wasn't always so dependable. In fact, lots of times the work that they produced was shoddy. It wasn't up to par. Well, unfortunately, Andrew Bradford's company was asked to print an important address that the governor was going to be delivering. They didn't have the electronic equipment we have. Their printing press was a very, very primitive thing. And the whole document was put together in a very careless, sloppy way. Well, there was another person who saw this example of sloppy work as an opportunity. He himself prepared the speech. It was an absolutely beautifully done and very elegantly laid out document. And he gave it to the governor with his compliments and also provided a beautiful copy for each and every member of the assembly in Pennsylvania. Yes, he did get the contract. And I'm sure you probably figured out who this famous person was. It was Benjamin Franklin. Franklin, who was, quite frankly, in a position of being like an indentured servant for a number of years, knew that he could do it better. He was a very resourceful man and had very, very strong ethics. And his quality result enabled him to take away business from Andrew Bradford and his company. That's something that is always going on, isn't it? And that is part of what the American environment has typically provided to people. If you're able to come up with a better product, look at Apple and look at Microsoft and look at all kinds of little companies. When you are able to do something better than someone else, they are going to want to work with you, the businesses that have need of your services. And I think it's always, how can you improve what you're doing so that you are going to serve the needs of those people that you're wanting business from more effectively and efficiently? Benjamin Franklin was a man that ended up becoming extremely wealthy, was an ambassador for the United States, and my goodness, the story of his accomplishments, people still talk and write about them today, because he was a leader on so many levels in his time. He didn't just talk, he did. And that is something we need to remember ourselves. And I thought I would share that with you, even though it was done a long time ago. The principles, well, they're the same. They don't go away. And the business of competitive commerce will always go further. And that is something, it's going to go on forever. It will never disappear. And that is what has allowed certain civilizations throughout history to rise and to fall when there was a change due to technology or something else. It's an old story, but it repeats itself over and over again. And how many times have we heard the statement, if you're not willing to learn from history, then you're, well, you're destined to repeat the same mistakes over and over again. Well, I'm sure a lot of you are just sort of rolling and moaning and getting on the scales and wondering, ooh, I wonder if I put on those extra pounds. Well, I think Thanksgiving is a fabulous holiday, but today is Black Friday and people are out just doing all kinds of shopping. And I'm not there, but there's a lot of people that are, and they plan for this. And this mania that goes on always fascinates me. I participated in a Black Friday once. This is many years ago with a friend of mine. Her name is Barbara, and I had had a huge, huge dinner at my home. And, of course, it's a lot of work when you do that. And Barbara was one of my guests, and she stayed over, and she said, well, let's go into Seattle, because she loves to shop. We both love to shop. And I'd never done a Black Friday. So this was going into Seattle, and we did that. We had to be up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get to Seattle, one, so we'd have a parking spot, because we knew the crowds were really going to be intense, and two, we had to work out a strategy of where we were going to go, what we were going to do. So, because parking is so expensive in Seattle, and it always has been, we found an area that we could park in for a very, very small sum of money because we were one of the early birds. And we took the monorail into downtown Seattle. We were at the Seattle Center, and we went into downtown Seattle on the monorail, which is a wonderful experience. If you ever visit the area, you need to do it. Anyhow, we go downtown. The stores were open. And all kinds of things. Seattle's just magical around the holiday season. It's just absolutely magical. And so we were just ready to shop until we dropped. And the stores were open. And then they weren't open at 6 o'clock in the morning. They were open at 8 o'clock in the morning. So they've progressed. They've opened up earlier now. But we had an absolutely marvelous time until around 12 noon. And by 12 noon, we were so glad we'd gotten there early. By 12 noon, the amount of people that were out shopping, it was a mass of humanity. You could not even turn around in the stores. It was incredible. I just had such an appreciation for all of the clerks in the stores that were having to deal with this intense rush of people wanting to get to those sales. I've never forgotten that experience, and I can remember saying to Barbara after we finished, I think this is going to be my last time. First of all, when I've been cooking and doing all of this stuff the day before, I'm really sort of getting tired. And then I come out, and then you have to battle the crowd. Well, we got all the goodies we needed to get, and then we left, and the people were coming in literally by the thousands to shop in the downtown Seattle area. So I just have a lot of hats off to those of you that are willing to deal with the crowds, because that's not my positioning. But oh my goodness, I guess it's even gotten 1,000 times more intense since Barbara and I had our Black Friday experience. It's almost like the day after Christmas when all the sales go on, when they're trying to get rid of inventory. Oh my word. People are up and at it bright and early again. I'm just amazed. But again, to those of you that have the courage and also have the stamina to do it, I tip my hat to you because I think that's great. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. If you're like so many people, if you've had a huge turkey and find that you've got leftovers and you groan and go, oh my goodness, what am I going to do with these turkey leftovers? Well, I have a couple of recipes that I really think are good. And if you're like me and you enjoy Mexican food, well, I've got some turkey enchiladas that I think you would absolutely love. And it's going to be flavorful, and I'll share this one. And there's also a recipe for a minestrone made with turkey. But the truth is, turkey bones, everything, just put them into your chicken broth or just let them boil in water and your soups. Make soups with the bones and the leftover meat. I break up the carcass, put it in a big pot, cover it with water, add some onion and seasonings, and just let it cook away for a couple of hours. And then I strain it. And then you have a good broth. And if you want more flavor, you can add either your beef broth or your chicken broth, whatever you like. And then put in your vegetables, whatever you want to do, canned beans, anything that is your pleasure. You can make a soup with your turkey that would just be absolutely wonderful. But these enchiladas, I think, are terrific. And they're easy enough to make. This is what you would need for turkey enchiladas. You're going to need about a tablespoon of your favorite oil, about 1.5 cups of freshly chopped onions. You're going to need a teaspoon of chili powder. You're going to need about 2 cups of diced turkey. You're going to need a jar of taco sauce, unless you have a favorite one that you make your own. You need a can of black beans. You want to rinse them and drain them. And then you're going to need 1 cup of cooked rice, 1/2 cup of cooked corn, or frozen corn, excuse me, and that needs to be just drained and thawed first and drained. And then about 1/2 pound of your pepperjack cheese, the spicy cheese, and you want that shredded. That's going to come to about 2 cups. And if you're like me, you always use extra. And then 1/4 cup of chopped fresh cilantro, and you're going to need 6 8-inch soft taco-sized flour tortillas. You can also do this with corn tortillas if you don't want to use the flour, but you have to remember they're going to have an entirely different type of flexibility. So just be aware. You can use the corn instead if you want, but it's going to have a different consistency to it and not as pliable. And then, of course, you always want to have sour cream as a side with this, maybe even some additional salsa and or cheese. Now, this is what you do in a big skillet. You want to put your oil in, and then you want to add your onion and your chili powder, and you want to cook it, stirring until the onion is almost tender. That'll take you about 10 minutes. And then you put your turkey, 3/4 cup of the taco sauce, your beans, rice, and corn. You mix it all together, heat it through. It's going to take you just a couple of minutes. Remove from the heat and stir in 1 cup of your pepperjack cheese and your freshly chopped cilantro. And you take 3/4 of the cup of the remaining sauce and you spread that in the bottom of your 13x9 baking dish. And you want to heat your tortillas just a little bit, not a bunch. And you want to spoon the turkey mixture in right down the center of each of your tortilla. You fold the edges of each tortilla in and then over the two short sides of the filling. And you start with one of the stuffed tortillas, put it in your pan, and that's your baking pan that you're using. Put them in seam side down, and then pour the remaining sauce over your tortillas and sprinkle with remaining cheese. You want to cover it tightly with foil. Bake it until it's hot, which is going to take about 30 minutes in a 350-degree oven. And you're going to bake it for that 30 minutes, excuse me. And then what you want to do is uncover it. And then I like to add extra cheese at this point. You may not want to do it, but I like to do it. And then you bake it another 5 or 10 minutes. And if you want it to really get brown on the top, stick it under the broiler for just a minute or two, and then have your sour cream on the table, have a nice salad. This is just going to be a great way to use the leftover turkey meat. You can use the white, dark meat, doesn't make any difference. It's absolutely wonderful. A soup can be made of it. You can always freeze a soup for those nights that you or days that you just don't want to be bothered cooking. And you are going to find yourself having a very, very happy family. And remember, even with the enchiladas, the turkey enchiladas, you can do a number of different things with it. If you don't like the beans, use something else as a substitute. If you don't like the rice, find something else as a substitute. It's great. Use your imagination. There are so many things that you can do with food that can adapt, one, to your dietary needs, whatever they might be, and two, can fit whatever your family prefers, but good food and using leftovers. Boy, sometimes that is such a challenge for people. I like leftovers, but we have members of our family that don't care for leftovers unless they're done in a very creative way. So whatever works for you is going to make everyone very, very happy. I also wanted to say, I know we're just about out of time, that it is very fortunate for us that we are able to be in a position where we communicate, where we have so many things around us that are available to us. And I think it behooves us this Thanksgiving weekend to be awake, to open our eyes, and to really appreciate everything that we have around us. It has taken a lot of people, a lot of years, to evolve to the point of knowledge where we have better products than have ever been produced before. And we also have new problems because of things that we were not conscious of before. This is an ongoing challenge for us as human beings. It's always going to be there in one form or another. So as you go about your daily life, if you notice that there's something that you can change for the better or you can make better, be so grateful that you're in a position where maybe you can submit your idea or develop an idea or a behavior, a new habit. It's going to empower you and the people around you to have a better quality life. Remember, everything starts with a thought. Everything starts with a thought. And that thought, when it is nourished with action, solid beliefs, good investigation, exploration, it allows it to come into physical manifestation where it can really make a difference. Whether it is developing an underwater camera, to figuring out a better type of toilet paper, sewage treatment, I don't care what it is. We can always improve and never underestimate your creative possibilities because your life is meant to be as rich as you possibly can have it, mentally, physically, spiritually, and emotionally. This is Donna Sebo. This Thanksgiving weekend, have an absolutely awesome time. Be safe. Be patient if you're shopping. Don't be in a hurry. Take your time. Remember, you are the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll be back with you right here, same time, same place, here on BBSRadio.com. Donna Sebo, bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.